Welcome to Adventures in Artslandia. I'm Susanna Mars, and today we are so lucky to be recording at KBOO. So thank you, KBOO, for giving us your studio so we can talk to Manita Gandhi, who is in Chicago. Today's adventure is with Manita Gandhi, the incredible talented actress and writer who wrote Motherland, a one-woman show about a trip to India that changed her life. To tell more would give it away. I'll just say that you're not going to want to miss this show. It's going to be a featured event at the Unconscious Bias Symposium at Portland State University on March 3rd and 4th. There are also going to be performances of Motherland on the 5th. That's the one I'm going to go see. The Unconscious Bias Symposium is presented in partnership with Age and Gender Equity in the Arts and the PSU Office of Global Diversity and Inclusion. The symposium events will explore how unconscious bias influences our behavior and impacts our lives and the art we create. The focus of 2017's symposium is gender bias and the intersectionality of age, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender variance, nonconformity, and disabilities. It's going to bring together local and national artists, including Manita, who I'll be talking to in a few minutes, actress, poet, and playwright Dale Orlander-Smith, actress and comedian Michaela Watkins, who was a part of the regional theater scene here prior to her move to Los Angeles, and she's well known for her role on Hulu's Casual and a stint on Saturday Night Live, and our own Louisa Sermol, currently in Broadway Rose's Company. Manita Gandhi is the American-born daughter of Indian immigrants. And like many in her generation, she feels stuck between two worlds. She explores this in her one-woman show, Motherland, which charts her coming of age. Welcome to Adventures in Artslandia, Manita, and thank you so much for taking time to talk to me.
Thank you so much for having me, Susanna.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's fun to talk to you. I feel like I know you because I've been watching video and reading about you, and I feel like, oh, that's my friend, Manita. So I was curious, how has Motherland been going for you? And not to give anything away to listeners, but part of the show is devoted to working through a particularly difficult event during a trip to India. And I was wondering, as you're performing the show, are you finding that your way of digesting this event has shifted, and does the script evolve as a result?
That's a great question, Susanna. So initially, when I wrote Motherland, the incident that was a traumatic incident in my life when I went to India, although a lot of other very beautiful things happened in India, which are in the play as well, it was hard. I think anytime, whether or not we are artists or actors or writers and we're used to taking on other roles, it's very different to really relive something that's traumatic for oneself. And at the beginning, when I was writing the play, I didn't actually put the event in it, and I'm okay sharing what the event is. So I was assaulted when I was in India, and that's in the play as a plot point, just as it's a plot point in my life. And when I was writing the play, I knew I wanted to write about India and just all the magic that I experienced there. And, you know, the two worlds that I live in and the dichotomy of that, of being Indian and American. And I kept skirting over the assault. And when we were at our first table read, it was at the same time that this documentary, India's Daughter, that was done by BBC director Leslie Udwin, had just come out, and the Indian government had banned India's Daughter from being shown in India because they thought it would defame the country. And I had a very strong visceral response to that. The documentary covers the gang rape of a young woman named Jyoti, who was raped, and then she died from the incident because of the injuries that she faced from the gang rape in 2012. And the documentary interviews some of the rapists and some of the government officials who don't really show any remorse for Jyoti. And I was so upset by the ban of this movie by the Indian government. My response ended up being to do some rewrites and to write about my own assault in detail, because I began to recognize that while I have healed from my assault, which happened in 2009, that there was a part of me that for some reason was victim shaming myself, that felt as though if I talked about this event happening to me, that it would put a poor light on my family or myself in some way. It was a strange cultural norm that I didn't know was inside me. So I decided to write about it in detail, and it ended up becoming a very powerful part of the story, I think both for the audience that watches the play, for the play itself, and, you know, to answer your question, for myself as an artist. And it was hard going through that initially, but I'll say that every time I perform the piece, my body does cringe a little bit before I get to the assault, but, you know, I survived that event. My character survives that event in the play. And what I have learned is that what it does for the audience is truly an incredible thing. We're all in it together. And unfortunately, there are so many women, men, of all different ages that have experienced something like this. And I think they're able to really connect with the play and connect with the part of the play that I think is so important, which is just because something traumatic happens to you, it doesn't define who you are for the rest of your life. And there is a way to help people and turn it into something positive. So I think I haven't rewritten that section of the play too much, but I am constantly learning from each audience that I talk to how it affects them in the world. And I think with our current political situation, a lot of people, as you and I were just chatting beforehand, you know, really need stories of healing. I think right now people are so hungry for stories by people of color and women of color. And I didn't realize that when I was writing the play.
I saw I Am Not Your Negro last night, and I think James Baldwin's suggestion that we look unflinchingly at our history's ugliness speaks to that same thing, that you're setting a beautiful example of being able to look at something that is very painful and you're very vulnerable in sharing it, and just setting the tone for your audience that this is the type of communication that is important for us right now, to really connect at a deep level so that we can get through these tough times together, truly together.
Yes, I think it's, you know, I think storytelling on its own is just healing in its own right. I think that's why, whether or not you are in the industry or not, we are all naturally drawn to stories. It's how we connect with one another, and it's how we share our pain and our pleasure and how we can learn from each other. And, you know, I like to think, and I should just say this, I like to actually think that I call my play a dark comedy. That's how I define it, because I feel as though 85% of it, 90% of it is actually, there's a lot of humor in it, you know, and then there's not. But I also just think that's how life happens. And, you know, and to what you were just saying, I think it's so important that we don't ignore that, so we can learn from our history.
And I think, you know, what you say, life is a dark comedy. I mean, that's just how it is. And if you don't feel that deep grief, I mean, loss, on so many types of loss in this life, if you don't feel those depths of despair, I mean, I think it really helps you feel the full spectrum of life. You know, without that, there isn't the high joy of, you know, the delight. And it kind of leads me beautifully into the next thing I wanted to talk to you about is, I watched the film that Andrew Fowler and Yining Zhao and Avinash Chalk made about your relationship with your cultural identity. And I thought the film was absolutely beautiful. And the relationship that you have with your father was so moving and beautiful. And I had a very close relationship with my father, who passed away in 2011. And the love you guys have for each other is just palpable. And I just cried just to be, I felt the love between you so strongly. And I just wondered if I could borrow him, you know, when I need a dad.
I'm sure that my dad would love that. You know, it's, when I first wrote the play, this was actually the first full-length play I've ever written, and I had no idea. You know, I'd never done a solo piece. I'd never written a full-length play before, and I workshopped it at Silk Road Rising, because Malik Jelani and Jamil Khoury, who are the artistic directors there, they approached me and they said, "Hey, we heard you wrote a 15-minute story, and it's good. We want to foster writers in Chicago. Do you want to write a play? We'll help make that happen." So I said, "Okay, yes, I do. And here are some of the things I'm thinking about writing about." And it was always aligned with my father for a couple of reasons. My dad and I are very close. I mean, I'm very close to my mom as well. But this particular story, there's a lot of parallels between my father's life and my life. A big part of the show is my dad's journey to the U.S. And the reason for that is, as I was writing, I found my father's suitcase from his first trip to the U.S. back in 1965. And I was helping my parents clean out their basement when they were moving. And it was so dark, but I'll never forget it. It was like this light was shining on this object in the corner. And I thought, what is that? And I walked over to it. And there was this, I mean, it's just this beautifully rugged leather suitcase that had J.J. Gandhi, Bombay, India, printed on the front. And on the back, in black Sharpie, someone had written, "When I die, discard this bag if you like. Until then, it stays." And I thought, that's really dramatic. Who wrote this? And my dad called down to me. I was in the basement, and I asked him, and he said, "Oh, yeah, that's my bag. Do you want it? You know, it's good for travel. You can keep it." And I realized that I hadn't known my parents as any in any role other than being my parents. And so I started interviewing my parents, asking my dad why he wrote that on his suitcase, asking my mom about how it was to come here and, you know, not really know the language or the culture and to raise kids here. And so that was very much a part of the story from the beginning, my father's and my relationship. And my parents were with me in India for my brother Milan's wedding. He had decided to get an arranged marriage. Milan is actually my cousin by blood. We adopted him. We went back to India, so he wanted to get an arranged marriage. And that was a whole other magical experience. And then after that, I fought with my parents really hard because they didn't want me to travel in India alone. But I'm a pretty stubborn person sometimes, which I think I also get from my dad. And he didn't want me to travel in India alone. He thought it was unsafe. And because I travel the world quite a bit, I said, "I travel by myself all the time. Please let me go." We found a meditation center that a family friend had recommended. And my dad and I went by ourselves on this 8-hour journey. He dropped me off at the meditation center. And then he asked me if I was comfortable staying alone. And I said, yes. And he left. And, you know, 4 days later, that's when the assault happened. And it's, you know, so much of, I know my parents both place a lot of guilt on themselves because even though it was of my own choice to go there, I think they felt responsible because they were there and took part in that decision. But it was my dad who, in the middle of the night when I got away from the man who assaulted me, and I was, you know, in this small room with a cell phone and could only answer things with a yes or a no, it was my dad who was on the phone with me who knew exactly what to ask and was able to talk me into a plan of safety. And then he, when I got to a safe place, he met me in the morning and we argued. We argued a lot because I wanted to file a complaint against this man. And my father was worried that we would be killed. And, you know, he just kept arguing with me, saying that I didn't understand that things were different there. And I've never felt so ready to die for anything in my life than I did in that moment when I just knew I couldn't leave India without doing something about this. And I don't know how my dad understood that about me. And so finally he said, okay. And I went and I filed a complaint and we had a journey back home to Mumbai, a long 8-hour journey that I think changed my dad's and my life forever. We've always had a close relationship, but I think going through that really shifted us. And then in the documentary that Andrew and Ening and Avinash made, they had asked if I was comfortable watching a video of the play with my parents. My mom was out of town, so she couldn't come. My parents to this day have not seen a live performance of the play. I wasn't ready for them to see the details of the assault when I was first writing it in its first incarnation. And then when that documentary came out, I had been asked to be part of the Ignition Festival of New Plays at Victory Gardens, and I was still rewriting some things, and I still wasn't ready to deal with that emotional component in the audience. So watching it with him on video, which is something I never would have thought of, but it came about because these gentlemen wanted to do this documentary, seemed like a perfect way. It was a safe way where we could watch it, where if we needed to turn it off, we could. And I think watching it changed a lot for my dad and I because, and I think you've seen it in the documentary, it, something that's not in the documentary, but that was said is, you know, I think he didn't know because I kept him out of the room when I was filing the complaint. He didn't know how I stood up to the men in that room and how I stood up to the doctor because they brought up the man who assaulted me. They brought him into the room while I was there the morning after filing the complaint. And he didn't know all of that. And he didn't know how much of my, the way my parents brought me up, the things that they have taught me, how much they've stayed with me until he watched the show. And for some reason, after he saw the video of the plane for my mother too, which is in the documentary, it's created a level of peace and acceptance between my parents and I that wasn't there before.
It's as though, at least when I was watching it and as you're talking right now, I think it's, as you, or as the show is described, as a coming of age, to experience as a parent, I would think, with your child in an extremely horrible and adult situation where not only the event, to digest it and to be able to stand up for yourself as you had to, for your parent to see you doing that and then to be open and engaged with them about it is just a whole new level of communication between a parent and child.
It really is, and I am constantly so grateful for my parents for their strength and their level of understanding and their support. You know, when I first told my dad that I wanted to put the assault in the play, you know, he thought it was a terrible idea, and he told me not to do it, and that was very hard for me. But I sent him a Mother Jones article about the protest being done against the ban against the documentary, and he understood it, and I think now he's totally changed, which is amazing because I think, you know, as we get older, we have viewpoints that we are stuck in. And I think for my parents growing up in India and then coming here to raise their kids, they were raised more in a culture of silence than any, you know, than any of us are. And so the idea of speaking out about a rape or about an assault to the public was such a foreign concept to them. They were so scared for me to do that. And now they have a completely different view. You know, The Atlantic recently published that documentary online, so anybody can see the documentary. And when I told my dad over the holidays when it came out, and he said, good. And I said, really? He said, yeah. He's like, everybody should see it. It was so different than the conversation we had 2 years ago.
And the courage that you had to include your parents and their willingness to be included is, you know, just an example of when you cross the scary road into intimacy in those types of stories, that's how hearts are changed. That's how we can change minds, is by revealing ourselves.
Yes, I think that's something that I'm sure you can attest to it as an actor as well. I feel like that's something that we strive for in our work all the time. And in writing, it was a big lesson to me because when I was writing the play, which is, you know, all based on true stories, there's things in the play that you'll see. It's, you know, there's choices that we're very proud of in our life and choices that we're not as proud of in our lives. And I really learned about myself as a writer because I realized that nobody learns from the safe stories and by us pretending to have made the right decisions. It's, we really have to explore the tough stuff.
Mm-hmm. And set the tone for that kind of bravery for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, after I watched the documentary, I had to have chai every day for a couple of weeks. I've been making the chai recipe out of this book that I've got called, what's it called? Run fast, eat slow. And I wondered if you know your chai recipe by heart, if you'd be willing to share it.
Oh my goodness. So You know, the thing about masala chai is that everybody makes it differently.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my dad actually makes the best chai I've ever had.
Well, because when you, in the documentary, you know, you talk about it, and if I'm not mistaken, you make it, right?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. I was just like, oh my, I was just riveted and I could smell it.
Oh my goodness. So my dad says that the trick is, and he's much better about doing this than I am, that the trick to masala chai is that you pour the black tea into the water right before it boils.
Mm-hmm.
Then as it starts to boil, you have to lower the heat. And it's and then after you lower the heat, you add the milk in.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the very careful process, which my dad is much better at, where you have to let the milk just about start to boil. It starts to almost raise as though it's going to come out over the pot. And then you turn it down.
Mm.
And then he likes to add, you know, cardamom and ginger. And then there's a masala mix that he makes that I don't know how to make. But I will try to find that recipe. He gives it to me. He'll make it at home,
mm-hmm.
and he gives it to me. But he said the biggest trick is making sure the milk doesn't boil over, but that you have to get it to that right point, and that's how you get the real silky texture of it and for the flavors to really mix well.
Oh my gosh, it's just so much fun to watch when your dad is arriving, or you arrive to your apartment and your dad, you say he's probably cleaning the kitchen, and I just, oh, it's just so great. I just really enjoyed how much you guys connect, and just, you just seem so happy. How's your dad doing?
He's doing great. Both my parents are doing great.
Mm-hmm.
They're both diabetic, so they struggle with that a little bit, and he does love his Indian sweets, but they're great. And then they were going to try to come up to Portland to see the show if they feel better.
Mm-hmm.
I think they might, which would be amazing to have them there. And if not, I'm doing a world premiere of it in 2017 in September. Gosh, it is 2017, this year in September.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they'll come out to Chicago for that. But yeah, they're good. They're excited. I think, you know, for years, and I'm sure a lot of people have gone through this, my parents had a very hard time with the fact that I was an artist. It's just not traditional. You know, I'm not an engineer. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a doctor. And I went back to India recently. It was the first time I went back to India since 2009 when the assault happened. I went back last year for work, and then my parents happened to be there. So we spent some time together there. And my parents have always called my acting career my acting hobby. You know, they could never really say that's her career for a long time. And I don't know what happened, but after this show, you know, I remember we were in India. We were at this designer that I love, Anita Dongre, and she dresses all of these beautiful Bollywood actresses all the time. We were looking for some clothes, and I was in the dressing room changing, and I just hear my dad say, "Well, you know, my daughter is a very famous actress." And I was in the room. I was cringing. I was like, "Oh my gosh, Dad, what are you saying?" and he was like, "She's very famous in Chicago. She wrote this show.
Aww.
I'm part of it." And he was so proud, and it was the first time that there was this shift. And I don't know what it is about writing or doing the show that has just, like, they're just so happy and they're so good. And I think they're just really excited that so many people in, you know, around the country have reached out about the show. I think they thought it was so specifically Indian American and so specific to me, they weren't sure, but they just are looking at the arts differently, because when they first came here, there were no South Asian actors, you know, at the theater or on television. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think they're just happy, and a lot of it has to do with they finally have peace of mind about their youngest daughter.
Well, and it's a good time, too. I think you're getting so much wonderful press about the pieces. And you told me about the NBC News feature article that people can look up online. And also you're going to be on The Takeaway on NPR prior to the Unconscious Bias Symposium in March.
Yes, it's been kind of amazing and lovely that, you know, the Atlantic published the documentary, and then NBC Asia America reached out to do this feature, and then to talk to John Hockenberry, who's a journalist that I've followed and loved for so long
mm-hmm.
on NPR to just talk about. It's been interesting. Some people really want to talk about the play and the process of writing the play, but more often than not, I think people are really interested in my family or in how, you know, in what we were talking about in terms of the healing that that stories can have right now. I think that was a big focus when I talked to them at the Takeaway. It was just really, you know, it's funny because it's an autobiographical piece, but I'm so used to talking about the play that sometimes I forget that, oh, these were real events in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while that hits me a little bit harder.
Right. That's all part of being alive, breathing the story. You know, it must be amazing to share this. And I'm sure your parents must feel, you know, the energy and people paying attention. And when there's that kind of attention towards something, it's, you know, everyone's ears are perked up right now for a story like this.
I think so. I think we all need stories of healing. And I don't know how you felt. I know that after the election, prior to the election, I was just feeling this great sense of progress. And I don't know if it was a false sense or not, but maybe it's because I had been working on this play, and I have been working on developing a women's leadership program with the company that I work with. And I just felt like a lot of good things were happening. And I was seeing a lot of good things in the art scene, just different voices being represented. And then all of a sudden after the election, I felt muzzled.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of artists I've been talking to feel exactly the same, and I've been struggling with it myself and how to inspire myself, you know, to making art when I feel afraid and depressed, really, about what's happening every day. As someone said to me earlier, you know, how are you doing? And I thought, it's kind of like after my dad died, there's this grief period right now of this deep loss of what I thought was real. And I can barely respond to how are you right now. I not honestly. And I try to, you know, say, well, I'm alive and my children are healthy and I, you know, things are good. But it's all couched in this general sense of anxiety about the lack of compassion being, you know, in the world right now. It's so disheartening.
It is really disheartening, and it is really hard. And I feel the same way when someone asks, how are you? It's always, well, here's how I'm doing outside of this crazy political situation. And to take politics out, it's hard to say that because we say it's politics, but it's so personal.
It is. So many, I mean, I even have a friend who, you know, works with a lot of people who may be impacted by the immigrants, new rulings on immigrant status, and people are, you know, having to shift how they're being in the world in such a big way.
Oh yeah. You know, it's yesterday I was taking a lift somewhere, and the gentleman who was driving, he was from Morocco. He came here in the late '90s. And as we were on our way, you know, the news was on and there was some news about how, okay, we're going to, you know, that there was going to be a push to get even more, you know, immigrants out or illegal immigrants out. It doesn't matter their age. It doesn't, you know,
mm-hmm.
And he got so tense. I got so tense, and he turned to me and he said, you know, I came here and I think he said 97. He said, and if I didn't have kids that were in school here, he said, I would go back. It's too scary every day.
Mm.
It's just too scary every day. And it was so heartbreaking. And I think, you know, as I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm looking at my dad's suitcase. I keep it in my room. And it's like, I think about all of the wonderful things my dad told me the reasons why he decided to come to the U.S., why I am here right now. And I don't know that people can feel the same way about our country, you know, than as they did in the 60s or 70s when they were immigrating here. It's really changing. But I also think, you know, in terms of what we do, I think now is such an important time for art, even though there is a sense of numbness and grief. I think now is when it's most needed. And, you know, I've had this opportunity. It just came up by chance, but colleges and universities have been reaching out to me quite a bit to bring my show to different colleges and universities. And there was, I went to Augustana College. That was the first college that I went to. And it was pretty close to right after the election. And I did my show and I did a talk back and we did a workshop on using your art as activism. And I have to say, it was the first time that I felt a deep sense of joy. And it's because I think a good place to look for hope is in our college environments, because those students, you know, they were like, yeah, this is awful. And we're upset about the election. And we're all going to be after school for buses. We're going to the Women's March. We're changing this, this, and this. They're not feeling defeated by it. They just are really active to change. And I was like, wow, this is the energy that I wasn't feeling. That, you know, so I think when we're looking for hope, we can always look to the arts. And then I think there's a lot of exciting things happening at colleges and universities. They have a certain energy and drive that I hope we can all piggyback off of when we need it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like earlier you were saying your dad was concerned or your parents were concerned about you not being a doctor or a lawyer. But I think as time goes on in our world, we're going to find that the work that we're doing in the arts is just as important and life affirming and giving as being a doctor and giving someone CPR in an emergency.
Yeah. I mean, it's all different kinds of healing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's all part of the same organism, the body, which is part of your community, which is part of the world, part of the universe. It just keeps, it's like the Bernoulli effect. It just keeps going. Yeah. I so appreciate your taking time to talk to me and visiting Adventures in Artslandia. And I just want to remind everybody who's listening that Motherland, Manita's show, is going to be a part of the Unconscious Bias Symposium at PSU on March 3 through the 5th. And you can find details about the event and tickets for Motherland at ageinthearts.org. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you. Hopefully I can seek you out and give you a hug and thank you for your great work.
I would love to chat with you. And Susanna, may I add just one thing?
Sure, of course.
You know, one thing that I really want to share that I'm learning has become really important to me is as I go around and I do this show, and I know I felt this for a long time, particularly as a female person of color, an artist, I am really thankful for, you know, to be a part of this symposium. And I've been really feeling in my heart just grateful to go around and do my show because of the message of the show. But also, there are a lot of people that come up to me that say, thanks for telling this story, because I'm a woman of color, or I'm a person of color, and I didn't know that I could write a play, or I didn't know that anyone would want to hear my story. And I hope that continues to inspire, and that is also changing, you know, in our artistic environment, that we are able to give more women and more women of color chances, you know, and people of color chances to tell their stories, because I think we all need it. And that's something that's been a really strong learning lesson as I've been doing it, is that people are still so hungry for that, because we still very much need these stories to be told.
Yeah, and
thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. We were just talking about this before we rang you up. Not only do we need the stories, but we also need people who are going to stand up to make sure they're heard and have a forum. And it takes work. It takes actual boots on the ground, for want of a better term, for people who are going to fund these types of programs, and also who are going to stand up for them and not just say maybe, but are going to say, yes, this is going to happen.
Yes, it's so true. I mean, I think if Malika Jelani and Jamil Khoury of Silk Road did not come up to me and say, hey, we heard this, that you were writing, do you want to write? I probably wouldn't have a play. I probably would have written something, or maybe not, who knows, but it's because somebody took a risk on me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It's because they took a risk on me, and then, you know, Victory Gardens took a risk on me to be part of their festival, and then another festival, you know, OSF took a risk on me to be part of their Asian American festival. That's literally been my journey. And so I try to do that for everyone that I can. And I think what you're saying about it, it does. It's one thing for us to say that we want more of it, and it's very different for us to go out there and do it.
Yeah.
And part of that's going to be taking a risk on someone you don't know.
Right. And it feels really good to know where I stand on that. You know, I think prior to the election, I was not really sure how I could stand up for that. And I think I know how now.
I love that.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much. I'm really looking forward to meeting you, and just have a wonderful trip out here and great days up leading up until that time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.